Morning, everybody. My name's Danny Marsh. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Sunny for asking me to do this. I'm exhausted. I got off a plane last night really late. I was in Chicago for a few days on business. I didn't sleep. I got up really early this morning, and you're all going to get the gift. You know, that's all there is to it. You're going to get the gift. I have a sobriety date. It's April 24th, 1990. I have a home group. It's the Tuesday night solution group meeting. We used to meet at Sherman Oaks Hospital, and now we meet on Zoom. I have a sponsor. He's a little garden gnome from Jerusalem, Israel. His name is Yisrael C. And he knows he sponsors me. Like we speak regularly. He knows me by name. And I'm right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love AA. And if you're new, I'm sure you're thrilled for me. If you're new and you're shaking heroin out of your spinal fluid, going, oh, I'm really happy for the Jew in the square. Because when I was new and I heard you guys were having a good time, my hope was that you would get hit by a bus so I could see how spiritual you really were. Because I got here dying of alcoholism. And talking about step 10, I was sponsored for many years by a man named Scott Redman, who I love and miss dearly. And he gave me tools that transformed my life. And one of the fulcrum of changes that he introduced me to was a really intense and devout practice of the 10th step. And the way he would, so I drank, right? I drank copious amounts of alcohol for a wicked long time. If I didn't, I wouldn't be sitting on this screen at 9 o'clock in the morning. And I also, I talk a lot about drugs. I'm sorry if the talk about drugs offends anybody. You know, Bill Wilson waited until the 7th page of his story to talk about drugs. Dr. Bob waited till the 6th page of his story to talk about drugs. I thought if drugs were good enough for our founders, they were good enough for me. And I did a boatload for a really long time. I really enjoyed freebasing with sex workers. It was one of my favorite pastimes. I don't do it so much anymore, but you know, because my wife frowns on it, but I would if I could. So I drank and I did a bunch of drugs and I couldn't stop drinking. And I come from, you know, I hear all kinds of really scary and hurtful and sad stories in Alcoholics Anonymous about upbringings. And that's not my story. I came from a really lovely nuclear family. I had a mom and dad, a baby brother, and then I had a little baby sister. there wasn't alcoholism. There wasn't any of the things that I hear that have gone on in people's lives. Yet I was bodily and mentally different from my fellows. Like all of my friends had a different skill set than I did. And there was no way that I could get to where they were from where I was without a drink. You know, and once I took that, my grandfather was a rabbi in Hollywood. And my first drunk was at my bar mitzvah. And I drank before the ceremony. And he had invited 1,800 of his favorite congregants to watch the prodigal grandson get bar mitzvahed. I threw up all over the pulpit. I almost didn't make it through the Torah portion. I embarrassed him. I embarrassed my family. We had a party afterwards. And I continued to drink and throw up and drink and throw up. And the following morning, most normal people would wake up after that spree filled with remorse. I woke up after that spree and my only thought was, I cannot wait to do this again. Because that sense of ease and comfort produced by the first drink was a feeling that I had never felt before that I needed to feel again. And I drank. If you got between me and the drink, I would kill you to get to the drink. It was that simple. If you stood between me and whatever I needed, I would walk wide swaths around you to get to what I needed. And I drank like that from the gate. And I did drugs like that from the gate. I smoked pot. I hated pot. Hated pot. I smoked it every day for a decade, but I hated every minute of it. And I felt like a little puppy on linoleum. You know, I was really, really busy, but I never went anywhere. But I was really, and I solved my pot problem with cocaine. I really enjoyed cocaine. I did a whole, I did it all. I'm not going to talk about, I'm not going to do like a drunk story for a while because this is a talk on the 10th step, which for me changed my life. So I drank, right? I drank copious amounts for a really long time. In March of 1990, I was doubled over in a whole bunch of pain. I went to Cedars-Sinai emergency room. They gave me a shot of Demerol. They said, whatever you do, don't drink. And I said, right. And I went home and I drank a fifth of vodka out of the bottle because that's how I drank. And by that point, I had progressed to if I made it to work on the drive home, I would drink two little airplane bottles of vodka. I'd crawl back into bed. I would drink a fifth and a half of vodka. I'd pass out. I'd wake up the next morning. I'd brush my tongue. I'd throw up the bile of the vodka from the night before. I would get back into bed, kill whatever vodka was left, and then see where my day took me. So when they told me not to, they gave me a shot of Demerol and they said, whatever you do, don't drink. I drank, right? Because I cannot stop drinking. Here's where I started to understand how the disease of alcoholism manifests itself in me. I believe I play by a different set of rules than anybody else on the planet. And whatever you citizens have to adhere to, I'm a little different and I'm a little special. And don't you know what I've been through? And I'm an opportunist of the 10th degree. I can get away with shit stuff. Pardon me. I can get away with stuff that nobody else can because I hid behind some of the experiences in my life for a really long time. And I knew I was going to a doctor that morning and I knew he was going to draw blood. And I was convinced to my innermost self that he would not find alcohol in my system. And he drew the blood and he came back and he said, do you drink? And I said, yes, sir. I have a glass of wine a night like anybody else. And he said, it's noon. You have a 0.25 blood alcohol level. He said, you also have a distended liver, and I'd like to check you into the hospital to detox your liver. And as they were detoxing my liver, the detox was too hard for my heart to handle. I had an atrial fibrillation of my heart. I ended up in coronary care for 3 days. And then they said I was a candidate for the chemical dependency unit. So they were detoxing me with Ativan, and I really liked Ativan. It just kind of took the edge off. They thought it'd be fun to watch the Jew play volleyball on Ativan. So I broke my ankle in two places. And then they said, we're going to a place called the Log Cabin. And I thought, cool, pancakes. Like I can do Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a civilized deal. And you got to understand, I was the same height that I am now. I had the San Fernando Valley crystal meth speed drummers mullet going on. I had a huge bushy beard. I weighed 255 pounds. I put on a purple and gold striped shirt and gold MC Hammer harem pants, and they wheeled me down Beverly Boulevard and up Robertson Avenue at 7 o'clock in the morning. And how you guys knew I was a newcomer, I have no idea. But you did, and you were really kind, and you pushed me over in the corner and you said, come back again tomorrow. And I probably said something like, leave me alone, because you guys look bright and shiny, and there was no way for me to get there from where I was sitting. And I'll never forget, I wrote that night in the hospital, I wrote, went to my first AA meeting filled with a whole lot of people, a whole lot sicker than I am. And filled with a whole lot of people, a whole lot more willing to get well than I am. And that was my introduction to AA. And I did 30 days in the hospital, and it was a beautiful experience. And after 30 days, they passed a coin around. Danny, we love you, Danny. You're amazing, Danny. You'll be president of AA someday. Because I'm an incredible opportunist, and I know how to tell you exactly what you need to hear to get you off my back. Because all I really want is for you to get off my back. And I put the coin in my pocket and I got in my car and I went to a liquor store and I bought two-fifths of vodka and I went home and I started drinking again. And it talks about me really specific in our literature where it says the difference between the heavy drinker and the alcoholic is the heavy drinker, given sufficient reason to stop, stops. I had a distended liver and atrial fibrillation of my heart. I was told if I drink, I'm going to die, and I cannot stop drinking. I cannot replace the cycle of spree and remorse with the cycle of commitment and surrender left to my own devices, no matter what. And on April 23rd, 1990, I was standing on the front porch of my house with a half-drunk bottle of vodka in an overnight bag, waiting for my mom and my baby sister to take me back to the hospital. And that look of pain and fear and terror and sadness and disgust and hurt that I saw in their eyes in that moment, I haven't had to see in anyone's eyes in over 33 years. And if that's as good as Alcoholics Anonymous gets, I can't pay you back in freaking lifetimes. So when Sonny says, can you give a talk? You bet your ass I can. Because I got two actions. I'm either walking towards a drink or away from a drink. Those are the only two actions I have in my life. And the more actions I take walking away from a drink, the greater the opportunity I have to live a life that I was unequipped to live when I got here. And I firmly believe that on April 23rd, 1990, I could not stop drinking. And on April 24th, 1990, just like it says on page 85, the drink problem had been removed. Without any thought or effort on my part, it just had. And I believe now what I didn't know then is that that was the beginning of the experience of the touch of the master's hand. Because I couldn't stop drinking, and something bigger than me separated me from a drink. So I got busy in AA, and I got a sponsor, and we never really worked the steps, but it was okay because we didn't drink. And then I got another sponsor, and we worked the steps as he saw them. And so you can imagine, like with the mullet and with the harem pants, there was not a lot of dating. I know it's shocking, but there was not a lot of dating activity. So I stalked this woman because I'm a stalker. And she went to my morning meeting and I conned her into going out with me. And right after we went out, she said, honey, I'm going to go to Hawaii with a friend of mine. What I heard was, honey, I'm going to go to Hawaii and have sex with everybody on the island except you. So I called my sponsor and I said, what do I do? He said, I'm going to tell you exactly what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, okay, I need direction. He said, you're going to march home and you're going to tell her she's got a choice, you or Hawaii. And if she chooses Hawaii, you pack her bags and you throw her ass out on the street. And I thought, it's a little harsh, but I want to be that good AA soldier. And I marched home, and thank God she was at work. And I opened the big book to page 69, where it says now about sex. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. Counsel with others is often helpful, but we do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. And six pages prior to that in the book, it says, for any of this, this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God, which means my job is not to take away you having the dignity of your own experience. My job is to share with you my experience. And so I read that part of the book. I called Scott Redman and I said, I need help. And he said, in that most beautiful, delicious, sweet, mellifluous voice, honey, I can help you. And I knew I was safe and protected in the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he invited me over to his house and we opened the big book to chapter five and we read chapter five and we got on our knees and we held hands with one another. And we said the third step prayer with one another, not a sponsor to a sponsee or a baby to a whatever. It was one alcoholic holding hands with another alcoholic, inviting God into the solution. And then he introduced me to the inventory process, which is the fourth step and the 10th step. The 10th step to me continued to take personal inventory. So what is an inventory? Resentment, fear, and sexual misconduct. The three areas of my life where alcoholism presents itself the most, where if I treat it like a real piece of business right here in front of me at all times, I have an opportunity to grow and change in ways that I was ill-equipped to do when I got here. Resentment's the number one offender. It has the power to actually kill. These resentments must be mastered, but how? I couldn't wish them away any more than I could alcohol. And my favorite part is the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, which means it didn't have to happen. I just had to think it happened. And I have tremendous mind reading skills. Like I can read your mind behind your back like nobody's business. So It didn't have to happen. I just had to think it happened. So what do I do with this? That is the blueprint of my alcoholism, right? I get resentful all the time. I'm 33 years sober. I get resentful all the time. But my responsibility in the 10th step is to treat my resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous so I don't punish the people in my life for my alcoholism, right? Resentment's the number one offender. Let's say I get resentful at my wife. I know it's shocking. I know it's hard to believe, but let's say I get resentful at my wife. The cause, she said good morning, but I knew what she meant. Like, I know what she was thinking. And so she said good morning. What she meant was, when are you going to take care of this? Why haven't you taken care of this? What, you're a loser. Basically, you're a loser. She said, good morning, I'm a loser. So I'm resentful of my wife, the cause she said good morning. What does it affect in me, right? It affects my self-esteem because I'm married beneath me. It affects my pocketbook because I've wasted way too much money on this woman. It affects my ambition. It makes me want to be less of a good husband. It affects my pocket, my personal relations, because I'm willing to assassinate her character to anybody that will listen. And it affects my sex relations because I start withholding all of this from her, right? And all she said was good morning, but I got alcoholism. I got a nasty case of alcoholism. So it tells me what to do with that information. We disregard the other person entirely. The resentment's mine, right? So what are my defects of character that if God were to remove, I would no longer have the resentment against my wife? I'm punitive. I'm retaliatory. I'm a mind reader. I'm grandiose. I've got false pride. I'm sober longer than she is. And I do AA so much better than she does. So there could be, and I'm closer to God. So there could be a little spiritual pride, right? I'm a mind reader. I'm a bully. One of my favorite relationship skills is silent scorn. It seems to bring us closer together. I loom, I get big and in her face. You know, so I got all of this stuff going on because I got alcoholism, and I don't get to pick and choose when the resentments come. They come, right? They just come because I got this disease. But my responsibility is to put that down on paper and call my sponsor or call another drunk and read who uses the same language that the book uses and say, these are my defects of character that if God were to remove, the resentment would be lifted. Because I know 33 years into this deal that God has no interest in me suffering from resentments. None. God talks about it later in the book where it says God's only interest for me is to be happy, joy, and free from resentment, fear, and sexual misconduct. So the second way that alcoholism presents itself in me is fear. I get afraid all the time. God has no interest in me being afraid, but I get afraid. And page 68 in our literature tells me exactly what to do with that. We put our fear down on paper. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be at once we commence to outgrow fear. And I'll never forget, my wife was in the labor and delivery room. So I had had this landlord when I was drinking who asked me to leave courtesy of the U.S. Marshals because she wanted rent. I didn't have any. The Marshals came and packed my bags and put them on the street. And I tried to track her down for 14 years and I could never find her. And every time I drove past that apartment, it was like a little knife in my heart because I wasn't clean. And the week before my daughter was born, I found the landlord and I called her up and I said, hi, my name's Danny Marsh. I'm sure you don't remember me. And she said, oh, I remember you. And I'm like, damn. And I said, I treated your property with great disrespect, and I was the most irresponsible tenant I've ever been in my life, and I treated you very poorly, and I don't live like that any longer. And one of the ways I go about not living like that any longer is to come to you and let you know that I made a mistake and to ask you what I can do to make it right. And she said, she started crying and she's like, I'm so proud of you. You're so beautiful. This is so, and I started crying and it was such a sweet moment. And then I made the mistake that you told me I had to make, but I made the mistake of saying, and I may owe you a little money. All right. I should never do that again. And she threw out this staggering amount of money, like staggering. And I said, what you taught me to say, which is thank you. I didn't mean it, but I said it. And I said, is there any way I can write you a series of post-dated checks till I'm 145 years old to cover this amount? And she said, sure. So I wrote all the checks and I wrote a note to her thanking her for the opportunity to make matters right. And she cashed them all the day we checked into the hospital to deliver my kid. All. She wiped me out. So we're in the labor and delivery room at 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm freaked out. I'm scared to death. And page 68 tells me what to do with that. I'm afraid I can't afford to be a father. I'm afraid I'm going to be broke. I'm afraid I can't pay rent. I'm afraid I'm going to be an abusive father. I'm afraid I'm going to hurt this unborn child. I'm afraid I'm going to, I don't have the skill set to be a dad. I'm afraid I'm going to drop this baby from the changing table. I'm afraid I'm going to bolt and I'm not going to stay around for this. And I called Scott at 2 o'clock in the morning and I read him the fear inventory. And then I got on my knees in that labor delivery room and said, dear God, please remove my fear of being an abusive father and direct my attention to what you would have me be. And I can tell you 22 years into this deal, I'm a great freaking dad. I am a great freaking dad because I don't punish my kid for my alcoholism. I treated an Alcoholics Anonymous. And then the sexual part of the inventory, where am I selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? Everywhere. Do I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Only if I open my mouth. Who did I hurt? I hurt you. I hurt me. I hurt anybody who got in my path. Where was I at fault? Again, just if I treat sex like I would any other problem, then where am I at fault or what are my defects? Am I filled with lust? Am I selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, dishonest? Those were like my dating tools, right? Selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and filled with lust. That's what I brought to the table. But God has no interest in me suffering from that. And then the most beautiful part of the sexual inventory is what should I have done instead? Who's the sober adult married man that I want to be? And at the bottom of page 69, it says, in this way, we help shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. The right answers will come if we want them. Right? So all of a sudden, this alcoholism, this active, well-treated alcoholism that flares up all the time now has a springboard for me with which to take to develop a relationship with a power greater than myself. And if I stay really current on my 10-step work, So my kid is 22 years old. She lives in Washington, D.C., going to school. Lovely. Like, I'm so proud of her. I am so, until she does something really stupid, which happens with great regularity because she's 22. But when she was 16 or 17, I came home from work one afternoon and she and her best friend were out driving. Now, my daughter did not have her license, and her best friend just got her license. So they were out driving, and I came home, and I went from being the loving, caring, kind, sweet, considerate father to a representative of the California Highway Patrol, like that. And they came home, and I laid into her. Honey, how irresponsible. I left out that my daughter was a nationally ranked debater. She was like number two in the country in the debate world. So she came home and I laid into her, honey, how dare you? You know, you're going to lose your permit. You know, you're never going to get a license. But I laid into her. And before I was done, she had texted me 4 articles to the contrary of everything I just said, because she's smarter than I am and will always be smarter than I am. And I don't have a chance. But what happens for me is, okay, so I'm 27 years sober at the time. What happens for me and what still happens for me and what often happens for me is that if I'm hurt, I only have one reaction, and that's to hurt you more. Like, I retaliate. We step on the toes of our fellows and we retaliate seemingly with and we don't know why. So I look at her with the same love I always look at her, and I say, "Babe, I got to tell you, I am so disappointed in you." And she's crestfallen. And my wife jumps in and says, "You know what? You can talk to our kid about anything you want. Thank you, Sonny. I see that. We can talk about our to our kid about anything you want, any way you want, any time you want, but you may not do that. That's not fair." So I had one thought, right? One thought, and that's that one bullet would take them both out. Because that's how I deal with my problems. But I did what you taught me to do, which is we pause when agitated or doubtful, right? That's the gift of the 10th step. We pause when agitated or doubtful. And I walked outside and I took a deep breath and I said, "Pop, who do you need me to be here? Show me who you need me to be. Show me what you need me to say and how you need me to do this." And I walked back in the house and I looked at my little kid and I said, "Babe, I am so sorry. I'm so sorry I got afraid. I've never been the dad of a 16-year-old before, and I don't know how to do this. And I promise you, standing here, that I will do everything in my power to never punish you for my alcoholism again. And you and I will figure out how this growing up thing goes together because I love you and I'm proud of you." And what happens for me is if I don't treat my alcoholism like a real piece of business in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I miss that. I miss the whole experience because I'm filled with selfishness and self-centeredness and grandiosity and self-delusion and self-seeking and people-pleasing and all of that stuff. So when my daughter was, I don't know, 7 or 8, we had this goldfish named Edie the goldfish. She was with us our whole life. And I came home from work one day and Edie was belly up. And I had to go tell my kid because when I was growing up, we had a family pet. My mom didn't tell me for a decade that the dog died. So I didn't want to be that dad. So I went in, I said, "Pumpkin, I got some really sad news. Edie the goldfish is dead." And she said, "Wow, Pop, that's really sad." I said, "What do you think we should do?" She said, "You know, Pop, we should take her back to the ocean and release her back to her family." And I thought, "Oh my God, that's so sweet." But we live in the San Fernando Valley and it's 8 o'clock at night. And I want to be a good dad, but not a great dad. I said, "So can you come up with something else?" And she said, "Yeah, Pop. We can flush her down the toilet. Eventually, she'll end up in the ocean." And I thought, man, I love my kid. So Cindy grabs Ruby. I grab the fish. I throw her in the tank. And I said, "Pumpkin, is there anything you want to say before we say goodbye?" And she said, and I quote, "Dear God, thank you for allowing Edie to be with our family this long. Now, please gently take her home to hers." 14 years ago, my sponsor Scott's dying of liver cancer in the hospital, and I'm holding his hand and I'm wiping his forehead. And I'm a runner. I am not a stayer. I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to stay in that moment. And 9 years ago, my mom's dying in the hospital of heart disease, and I don't want to be there. But I'm holding her hand and wiping her brow and kissing her forehead and holding Scott's hand. And the only thing that pops into my head is Ruby's prayer. "Dear God, thank you for allowing me to have Scotty this long. Now, please gently take him home. Dear God, thank you for allowing me to have a mommy this long. Now, please gently take her home." And what happens for me is if I don't treat my alcoholism and stay really current in my 10th step in Alcoholics Anonymous, I miss the whole thing. And I'm unwilling to allow alcoholism to make me miss anything. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. I don't know what you're bringing to us, and I don't know what it is that you don't want to miss, but I promise you, if you treat your alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have to miss anything ever. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Danny, for a wonderful talk. Oh, AA has no dues or fees for membership, but we